Muriel Gardner, Veal 1. So if I could ask you first of all, Muriel, could you tell me something about your life before the war? You know, for instance, where you were born and brought up, and something about your family.
Yes. Well, I was brought up in Liverpool, although I didn't live in Liverpool for very long. After I finished school, I went into the civil service, and I was then transferred to Manchester in Salford. So while I was there, I did a lot of welfare work in Salford, in the poorer parts below Exchange Station. And when I married a civil servant, and I went to live in Congleton. And because, of course, in those days, married women had to leave the service. I had to leave the service on marriage, but I'd only been left about 6 months when the exigencies of war made it imperative that they recruited staff again, and so they appealed for me to go back. And so I went back into the Ministry of Labour. And then, during the bombing of London in 1941-42, there was an appeal for men to relieve civil servants in London who'd been suffering from the Blitz. So my husband volunteered to go down, and I went with him. And so we landed in London, and I was in the employment exchange at Edgware Road. So I was stationed in the employment exchange at Edgware Road in George Street, which was a very interesting area because a quarter of a mile to your left, you had Hyde Park and Park Lane and all the wealthy people of Bayswater. And in those days, only the wealthy lived in Bayswater, so you had people like the Vesties, the ship owners, who lived there. And then a quarter of a mile up to the right, you had all the sleazy, demi-mondaine world of Paddington. So it was extremely interesting. And I remember when I was very new there, in the first week, I was interviewing a dirty old creature, an old lad, and I had to take her record of employment. And so I said to her, where were you last employed? And so she said, 3 and 1. So I wrote down 3 and 1. I thought it was perhaps some sort of dry cleaners. And so I said to her, and what is the address of the firm? So she looked at me as if she'd never before had such a low IQ to deal with. And she said, 3 and 1. 3 months and 1 off for good conduct. So I said brightly, you've been in prison then? So he said, yes. So I said, what prison are you in? So then she looked at me as if I'd gone beyond the bounds of my credibility. And she said, there's only one prison for ladies, and that's Holloway. So whenever I hear the word Holloway, I always think of it as a prison for ladies. But then I was put on a most interesting job, and I was made clerk of a panel, an appeal panel. So if employees were requisitioned from some firm or other, and the firm didn't wish to release them, they could appeal to this panel. Or if you, if a girl was of age to go in the services and she had some valid reason, then she could appeal to the panel for exemption. And I was a clerk of that panel, and the appeals had to be vetted first by an interviewer who would agree that they were fit to go to the panel. And that was the most interesting job, because we met all sorts of people, because everybody had to register, of course, during the war, high and low. So we had some very interesting incidents with the appeal panel. And we had on the panel, they were mainly, for instance, the personnel officers of all the big firms like Marsh & Seldrose or Abbey National Building Society, or people who were very sort of knowledgeable in the world of prostitution from the Paddington area, and people like Mrs. Mar Johnson, the Honourable Mrs. Mar Johnson, who was Somerset Maugham's niece, and a welfare worker, and people like that. So the panel themselves were very interesting, and then some of the people that you got there were very interesting. For instance, we had one occasion when it was very difficult dealing with the upper crust of society, when sometimes their surnames and their titles are quite different and you can't tell who is related to who. And I called Lady Mary Lucy Gower, who lived, had a flat somewhere near Bond Street. She had a maid when we wished she was born. She was appealing to keep this maid. So I called her to the channel. And I got a letter back from the Isle of Man, from the Countess of Granville, and Lord Granville was at the time the governor of the Isle of Man. And she said that she would be in London at this period visiting relatives. And she wondered if it would be in order if she attended the panel instead of her daughter, signed Rose Granville. And so I said yes, it would be in order. And then when she came, she was very, very nice little soul, dressed in a seedy black costume, although she was quite well worn. And she was very anxious to do all that she could to help the panel. And she did murmur something about the maid was necessary when the princesses called. And that was lost, because it appeared that Lady Mary Lucy Gower herself was of an age to be called up for the services. And so it switched to why wasn't she in the services. And Lady Granville said that she didn't really know. She thought that she probably had a medical certificate, and she said, I'd better send her in perhaps next week, and she can sort it out with you. But I think that you'll find that she has a certificate. And so when she had gone out, Miss Parsons, the personnel officer of Marshal Stelgrove, said, do you know, I think that she's related to royalty. And so we looked her up, and she was in fact the Queen's sister, Rose Lyon originally, but now Rose Granville. And I thought that that was pretty good, that she could so easily have said that she was visiting the King and Queen, because she was in fact staying in Buckingham Palace, but she didn't. She merely said, we will be visiting relatives in London. And I thought that said a lot for the way in which the royal family approach national matters. And then another time, we had another interesting one when we wanted the maid and cook of Baby Daniels. And so we called Baby Daniels. And she didn't come, but her husband came, Ben Lyon. And of course, Ben Lyon then was a lieutenant colonel in the American Army, and he came resplendent in his uniform, looking terribly handsome. And while he was waiting in the corridor to go in to the panel, he must have thought that he was in the middle of Clapham Junction, because every clerk in the building found occasion to walk down that corridor with a file in their hands to see Ben Lyon. And then, during the course of the interview, one of the panel said, well, what's the matter with your wife? Can't she cook? And he drew himself up and he said, you should see Baby cook a chicken. She cooks a chicken like she came from the south. I always remember that of Ben Lyon. So, you know, he cooked good chickens in the south. And so it was a very interesting time that. But at the end of about 18 months, this business of Anwar came up. And my husband applied to go to UNRWA, and that started the saga.
Before you tell me about that, this is very interesting, what you're saying about your work in the Ministry of Labour, because it must have been, you know, there must have been so many problems in wartime, you know, with the direction of Labour. Yes, are there any more?
The great thing, of course, was in the war with us was prostitution, because the Ministry of Labour, in every occupation, was listed with a number, so the occupation was known by a number, and there was no number within the Ministry of Labour Code for prostitution, because this hadn't come up in the war, but of course, during the war, prostitutes had to register. And so eventually they were put under entertainment, which I thought was rather nice, 474, entertainment. They were always a problem, because they were very difficult to place in war work. Because they would go into a factory and they would immediately announce that they were prostitutes, and then the rest of the girls wouldn't use the lavatories, and it was generally made very awkward. So prostitution became almost a sort of reserved occupation and was very much sought after, so much so that we wouldn't register anybody as a prostitute unless they showed us what they call their income tax form, which was a receipt from the police, because every so often, perhaps every 3 months, the police would round them up and they would go to the police station and pay a fine, unless they called paying their income tax. So unless they could produce the receipt, they weren't put into this very desirable category of prostitute. But we did have one firm in Mull, in Malvern Road, did offer to set up a separate department for prostitutes, and that was really good. They were doing light engineering, Solex, I think their name was, and they set up this department purely for prostitutes, and that solved a lot of our problems.
Was that SOLEX, Solex?
I think it was SOLEX, yes.
So, if that didn't happen then, presumably they were allowed to carry on with their prostitution, is that right, as a reserved occupation?
Yes.
Would you?
They were really interesting, not really, because you had all the sleazy sort of prostitutes of Paddington, but then you also had some very high-class prostitutes who perhaps had a clientele of about six men, who might include ministers and high-up army personnel, and they were extremely intelligent women, and one could relate very well with them and see their problems. You know, one woman I had, she was doing it purely to put her child through a public school, and when the fees had been paid, she said that would be the end, I'll finish. So they were really interesting lot. And another interesting thing was that When we were on fire watching duties, the men's department was in Marylebone Road and the women's department was in George Street. And we were very often on fire watching duties in Marylebone Road, and there perhaps would be about six of us on, because it's quite a big department. And if there was no alert, then two of you would go off for an hour around the corner to Baker Street to the Scotch House, and have an hour playing champagne in the Scotch House, and then you would come back and the two or others would go and have an hour off. And the people behind the bar knew us, and they used to make sure that we heard the alert, because there were always any noisy places. And one time we were in there, I and a friend, and we were playing champagne, and the barmaid called out, and she said, "You fire watchers, I've already called you once, the alert's gone." So we rushed off and down Marylebone Road, and I should never forget that, it remains vividly in my memory. This very dark night, and the searchlights flashing across the sky, and the noise of the aircraft, and the noise of the guns in Hyde Park, and all these almost like yellow tennis balls going arcs across the sky from the Beaufort guns in Hyde Park. And it really was like Dante's Inferno, but it was the most impressive, and it always remains vividly in my memory, that rush down Marlborough Road, Marylebone Road.
Am I right in thinking that it was Ernest Bevin who was the Minister of Labour?
Right, that's right, yeah. Ernest Bevin. Yes.
Did you ever see him?
When we got back to Marylebone Road, eventually, after this dash, about an hour later, a Mermaid Warden came in and he said, "I'm afraid the Scotch House has had a direct hit." And so it was very traumatic that all those people that an hour before you'd been drinking with, you know, had been eliminated. As regards Ernest Bevin, the only contact that I had with Ernest Bevin was that we had a pianist, probably she is not now known, but she was very well known at the time, Harriet Cohen, and she later almost with Dame Myra Hess in notoriety. She later burnt her hands and had to give up playing the piano, I believe. But she was a very noted pianist, and she had a maid, and I withdrew this maid from her. And she was curious because Mr. Solomons, who also was a noted musician, I had allowed him to keep his housekeeper, whereas I had withdrawn hers. And she thought this was extremely unfair. She didn't know that Mr. Solomon's housekeeper was slightly more than a housekeeper to him, but Harriet Curry wanted to know that. And so she appealed directly to Ernest Bevin, to the Minister of Labour. And that is the only time that I have ever seen a minister's file, and I have a whole ministerial file to myself to explain why I was withdrawing this name.
Do you think, you know, looking back during the war, given all the problems that existed, we, you know, with the direction of Labour, that the system worked well from your own experience? Was it fair?
Oh, it was very fair, yes. Yes, it was very well run. It was very well orchestrated, the whole thing. And this system of panels was extremely fair.
Was there ever any attempt to sort of bribe people? You know, I mean, stuff was short in the war.
Not that I ever knew, no. I was going to say this is hardly fair. It's not a system of bribery. But one of the panel, one that I was perhaps most fond of, I was very friendly with Diana Marr Johnson and kept up correspondence with her for some time afterwards. But I was also very friendly with one of our panel, and I was very fond of her, and that was Mrs. Flora Solomons. And she was the head of all the staff organisation of the welfare at Marks & Spencer's head office in Baker Street. And Flora Solomons was a member of the panel. And I was sort of fond of her, and I always rather treated her as one would one's favourite aunt. I was really fond of her, and if ever any member of the panel let me down and phoned up to say that they couldn't attend that day, I could phone up Mrs. Solomons and ask her if she would stand in, and she invariably would come round, and she was most accommodating. And she was, I didn't realise at the time, she was nothing like anybody's favourite aunt. She was an extremely important international figure. And she has written a book, which is extremely interesting, called From Baku to Baker Street. And they were millionaires in Russia, living in Leningrad, St. Petersburg, just opposite the Hermitage. And then, during the pogroms after the event of communism, he had to fly, father Berenson had to fly down to the south of Russia, and he started up again from scratch in Baku, in the oil area of Russia, and made another million. And then there was another program, and he had to leave there, and they fled to America, and he became a millionaire for the third time. And then Flora Solomons was very instrumental with Golda Meir in setting up the State of Israel. And when Churchill was wanting to provide places where people could, during the war, get a cheap meal, and he asked Flora Solomons to set up this organisation of restaurants, as she'd been so successful in doing a similar thing for Marks and Spencer's. And so she set up what came to be known as British Restaurants, where you could get a meal for 5 shillings. And she did, she called them communal restaurants, but Churchill said that sounded too much like communism, and so he thought it would be better if they were called British restaurants, which of course they were. And so Flora Solomons was an extremely interesting member of the panel. And I always remember one little thing, which in the beginning I thought that she must have come from some peasant stock before I knew her back down, because she would always ask if she could bring her own sugar, because she liked to have lump sugar, and that was very difficult to get in wartime. And so she brought her own lump sugar, and she always ate it separately from drinking her tea. And she said, this is a half back to Russia, where we used to hack pieces of sugar off the sugar cane and eat it. And so I had rather a vision of a peasant sculpture with sugar cane up in it, nothing as far from the truth at all.
Yes, so it was, you know, during your work with the Ministry of Labour that you heard about UNRWA, is that right?
That's right, yes. Because, of course, when in 1944, when the Allied commanders met to decide what they could do if and when they were in a position to invade Germany, one of the things that worried them was this business of refugees. Because they have had this problem with refugees impeding the war efforts in France, when the French, fleeing before the invading Russians, had so clogged up the roads that our armies had been bogged down and some of them couldn't even make Dunkirk. And so the army was determined that that would not happen again. And they knew that there were millions of people incarcerated in the slave labour camps and the concentration camps up and down Germany, and they thought that immediately these people were released, they would try to get home. Germany isn't such a big place that you can't walk across it in a few days, and so they thought immediately these people would try to get home in some means or other. And so they said, we must have some organisation which will come in with us when we invade Germany and keep these people in holding camps until such time as we can get them back home in an organised fashion. And so they said this must be a civilian organisation because we will not be able to spare the troops for such a big operation. And so UNRWA was born, the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. And in order to start the new organisation off, because people were in reserved occupations and couldn't get released, at least the calibre of people that UNRWA wanted to recruit. And so the Allied governments decided that they would release senior civil servants to start the organisation off. And as my husband was one of the senior civil servants, he applied to be seconded to this new organisation. What governments say and what governments are prepared to do are two different things, of course. And in the event, the British government proved very unwilling to release any of its senior civil servants, and only my husband and a man from the Unemployment Assistance Board, as far as I know, got released, and that was only because they made thorough nuisances of themselves until the government implemented its promise. So that's how we came to be in UNRWA. As soon as he was seconded, and I applied, and I was accepted as a welfare officer.
How did you feel about that? You know, did you want to join UNRWA? You know, was it?
Oh yes, indeed, yes, I did. I was very keen to join this new organisation because it was all worked in with my previous desire to be a welfare officer rather than a civil servant. And had there been enough money in the family, my father was a teacher, they were not very well paid. 70 years ago, and there was no money to send me to the university. I failed to get either a county or a state scholarship, which were very rarely given in those days, and so the next best thing was to go into the civil service, so that's how I landed in the civil service. But my main object in life in the early days was to be a welfare officer of some description, which is why I did welfare work in Salford. And so this all tied in with that, so I was very keen to join this new organisation. Mm-hmm. My husband had always been extremely interested in international politics, and he was a very political animal, and he had, in fact, before the war, he got friendly with a German station master in Paderborn in Germany, and he managed to get a lot of this man's possessions out of Germany for him. And then he was very instrumental in bringing out, I can't just remember the name of that, a family who eventually he got settled in Salford, he got settled in Congleton in Cheshire in a business, and he brought them out of Germany because they were Jews. And then he went over later on holiday, and he brought out, smuggled out for them a lot of their jewellery to set them up. This Olsen was the name in Congleton, and they became a textile firm in Congleton. I don't know whether it still exists, but he was responsible in bringing the Olsons out. So he was always very interested in international politics.
Was there any, at this time, of course, the Americans would have had quite a presence in Britain, and London in particular. Was this obvious in the early stages of UNRWA in London? You know, were the Americans heavily involved? Were you aware of that?
No, I wasn't really aware of it at all, because the Americans came into the war late, didn't they? In 1943, I think, at the end of 43. And so they weren't actually involved in the war effort. So, as far as I remember, there wasn't much evidence of American involvement, not in my early days in London. But of course, once we were recruited to UNRWA in 1944, the Americans were already in the war then, and after we had done training, a month's training in this country, and were shipped over to France. When we got on the coast of France, we found that there were really very few people that UNRWA had been able to recruit, partly because of this business of people being in reserved occupations and unable to get released, and partly because, of course, people were not very willing to volunteer to go into the Marston of War in 1944 when it was at its hottest. And so UNRWA had not been able to gather on the continent the number of personnel that she needed. When we had been training in London, we had been told that we would go in to take one of these holding camps over with a team of 12 to 15 people at least, and possibly 20. So we would have welfare officers and supply officers and doctors and nurses and all sorts of administrative officers and so on. To take over the camp. Well, in actual fact, UNRWA wasn't ready, and UNRWA had so few personnel that eventually she had to split us up into small, what she called spearhead teams of four. And our team, when it was posted up, consisted of my husband as director of the camp, myself as welfare officer, another administrative officer, an English woman called Miss Deed, and a young French doctor, Dr. Pierre Clément. And so that was our team, just the four. And I said, there were four spearhead teams, and UNRWA said that we will send you reinforcements as soon as we can get them. And so we were sent off into the American zone of Germany. When the teams were posted up, we were rather disappointed that we were going to the American zone, because we'd rather hoped that we would go to the British zone. But in the event, we were very glad that we did not go to the British zone, because there were difficulties in the British zone. For one thing, the British Army did not allow UNRWA to function in in the camps. They administered the camps, and they administered them in a disciplinarian way, which is essential in the army. I mean, they were used to a disciplinarian order, and so the camps were administered in an army way, and UNRWA was not allowed to function. And so the welfare side of things was not stressed to the same extent in the British zone, and many of the UNRWA personnel went home in disgust because they weren't able to operate properly. They were there merely as figureheads in the army-operated camps, and the army brought in sometimes German personnel to run the canteens and things, and so this was anathema, of course, to the displaced persons. And there was trouble in the British camps. And this did not happen, at least in the camp that we got to, in the American zone.